Are they number out sick? I mean, we're missing a number in class still, but does anyone know? So everyone's healthy, they're just avoiding this class. Yeah, I knew she was going to be gone. She had talked to me. Okay. We have a little time. Haley, would you like to introduce your guest to class? Hello, little sister Kiana. Not in this hour, but in fourth hour, we sing a song. And we make our guest sing a solo. It will be totally fine. You'll have fun. We smile a lot in class. Okay. Ezekiel, we're in chapter 40. Let's start with prayer, and we will look at our text. Father God, we thank you for the morning that you have given to us. We thank you for this time that we have to look in your word to know you, and Father, to see not just like what you're doing today and what you're doing in our lives, but to see what your plans are for the future. And give us wisdom as we think about these things. In the name of Christ we pray. Amen. All right. Hopefully, I have more than a blue screen today. But as I said, service is me. Okay. This will be our last lesson in Ezekiel. We are going to cover, we've kind of been plodding through, we're going to cover like a fifth of the book today. So, get ready. It's not going to be that bad. But because of the content, it's just easier to kind of take this all in a chunk for us. All right, Ezekiel. Chapter 40. when we come to chapter 40 through 48, what we're going to find is a lot of things that Ezekiel talks about dealing with the future kingdom. Now, for various reasons that we'll talk about as we go through the text, when he's talking about the future kingdom, he's dealing with some very specific issues. So this is where we come in your notes to this little notation here. For centuries, devout and scholarly Bible students, both Jewish and Christian, have struggled to interpret the vision described in these chapters, but they have by no means reached a satisfactory agreement. In a lot of places, even when there's deviation, like the majority of people are going to take a particular view kind of thing. And we don't necessarily have that here. There are at least four views that have emerged on this section of Ezekiel. All of them have strengths and weaknesses. So we are going to give some consideration to those four things. Number one, or the first kind of view, is Ezekiel is describing ideal worship. This is the ideal state of worship, and that's what he's describing. He's going to give a lot of detail, which, like I said, that's why we, in class, that's why I'm approaching this whole section as a large chunk, because all the detail goes together. So he's going to give us a lot of detail. And this interpretation would say all that detail is not meant to necessarily outline specific things, because he's going to give measurements and stuff like that. This view would say that's not the real purpose is to give like a blueprint for a physical building. The real purpose is he's trying to describe ideal worship and what would go into that. This view rejects the idea of a literal temple. So rejecting the idea that a literal temple will be built in Israel, this view spiritualizes the vision God gave Ezekiel and seeks to apply it to the church today. Its modern application would easily be the strength of this view. It doesn't mean that it's right, and for right now, there's one I'm going to advocate, but I'm not saying that the view is right or wrong based on that. It's just the strength. They're going to approach it that the specific stuff in the text is about, it's not about the size, it's about trying to describe for us some sense of ideal worship, like that we would have a place, we set a place aside for the Holy of Holies or something, you know, along those lines. In extreme views, they may assign like certain value to the numbers. Like, this is a really big thing, so it's really important. Or, you know, 9 is a number of, I don't remember if 9 has a significance. You know, 7 is, you always hear that about like completeness or something. 9 could be the number of planets, and so this is like celestial and heavenly. I'm not sure, but whatever it is, like they may assign something that would be pretty extreme. Most of the time, it's going to stay pretty lax because the focus is much more on the application. As kind of an example of this, a number of years ago, I preached through 1 Kings, and there's a lot of 1 Kings is really good, very applicable kinds of things as you're going through the kingdom and people and how they're interacting with God. There's a section of 1 Kings where Solomon builds the temple. While I feel that all those details are literal details, and I feel like they're all very important, I took most of that section in one sermon. It was like multiple chapters. Because to break it down, like, from a preaching perspective would be very difficult. Like today, we're going to talk about the measurement of a couple of pillars and the capitals on top. And that might be interesting, but not very good in terms of application for the church. So this view emphasizes application, but has kind of read that application back into interpretation. So the application may be good, but is it what would be represented by the actual text? When I went through that thing in 1 Kings, I was very clear. These are literal details, and I talked about that in the course of the message. It was just that I had to take it at a chunk, and we talked about some other things related to that for application, because those details weren't relevant to us as a church. All right, the second view is that Ezekiel gave the plans for the post-captivity temple. So he's predicting a temple, a literal temple. He's giving some plans in regards to how that little literal temple should be set up. But the temple he has in mind is the temple that they will build when they come back. So this would be the temple for Ezra, Nehemiah, and that kind of era. Haggai, Zechariah. So this is like their temple, and that's what this is anticipating. The third view is that Ezekiel's vision anticipated John's vision. Captivity, post-captivity temple. Okay, Ezekiel's vision anticipated John's vision in Revelation. Particularly the one at the end of Revelation. John has a vision of New Jerusalem. He also has a vision of a temple there. So this would be like a eternal state temple type of view. There are some strengths to that view. On the side of your notes, you should have a textual note if everything printed as intended. And they demonstrate some of the similarities between John and between Ezekiel in regard to this temple thing. So there's some relevancy there. And the fourth view, and the one that we're going to embrace wholeheartedly in this class, is that Ezekiel described a temple to be used during the millennial reign of Christ. So the last three views would all take the position that Ezekiel is talking about an actual temple. The question is more about the timing of that temple. which temple is he talking about? Post-captivity, kind of eternal state, end of things, or is he talking about the one in the kingdom? We are going to take the position that he is talking about the one that will be established in the kingdom. Post-captivity has some interesting elements to it. The difficulty with it is that the post-captivity temple does not match what gets described here. In fact, when Haggai is prophesying, part of the prophecy he gives in chapter 2 of Haggai is, isn't this so sad? Don't you remember what it used to be like? It used to be so good and glorious, and this is good, but it's not like what it really had been. It would be disappointing if this were your blueprint, and if this were the post-captivity temple, it would be like me baking something. Sometimes, especially like baking something off like a blog or something, are you guys familiar? People do like these recipes on their blogs, they take all these pictures, of, like beautiful, beautiful things. And then I would make it, and it'd be like, and so it'd be like the Israelites took a picture of their temple, their post-captivity temple, and they're like, nailed it, this is exactly what. But it's not at all what Ezekiel describes. So we're going to take this one, that it's the one associated with the millennial reign of Christ, with the Messiah. Now, in your notes, there is a picture, correct, of the temple? Excellent. So you can kind of see what it's like. That, of course, does not originate with me. In fact, it should be noted that it's by other people. But it gives you at least a layout that you can kind of look at as you're reading through and try to associate what you're reading that Ezekiel describes with an actual picture. I find that that's helpful in just kind of establishing where everything is. As you go through this passage, while the details may seem tedious to the modern reader, they would have a definite value to Ezekiel's contemporaries. Even more, this vision would have been extremely personal to Ezekiel. Why would this be personal to Ezekiel? Because he's a priest. He started his ministry, his prophetic ministry at the time. He should have been starting his priestly ministry. He has been preoccupied with the religious elements of Israel in his own like interaction with God through the prophecy. He's thinking about idolatry a lot. He's focused on like true worship a lot. The priestly things are things that matter, so that he gets to prophesy about the new temple. It's not just that he's trying to give information to other Israelites. God is giving something to him in the process. This is deeply personal to him. I understand how it goes together. All right, let's just kind of start at the beginning. We are not going to read this whole section because that would have taken up my whole period. It would just be me reading, and how dull. But we will kind of go through a little bit just to get the flow. In the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck down, on that very day the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me to the city. In visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel and set me down on a very high mountain, on which was a structure like a city to the south. When he brought me there, behold, there was a man whose appearance was like bronze, with a linen cord and a measuring reed in his hand, and he was standing in the gateway. And the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and set your heart upon all that I shall show you, for you were brought here in order that I might show it to you. Declare all that you see to the house of Israel. So what's happening is Ezekiel is once more transported in the spirit and transported back to Israel. Now in this case, he's transported back to the land of Israel, but he's also transported forward in time. And that's some of those differences when he says, I was on a high mountain, but there was a structure, in the city to the south kind of thing. He's demonstrating that the situation is different than it would be in his contemporary time, because Jerusalem had been destroyed years ago. So he's not saying to the south was the rubble or the ransacked city or anything like that, but there has been a change in what has taken place. In verses 5 through 27, Ezekiel's vision of the temple starts from the outside with an examination of the wall. The first entrance measured is the eastern gate, and that suggests that Ezekiel is to the east of the temple, that there, as he's got this measuring angel with him. They come in from the east. We'll deal with that in a second. But so they come into the east. Perhaps when he came and was transported, he was on the Mount of Olives. And that would make sense geographically, that that's where he would come in. And prophetically, that would have some significance. That's how they come into the city and come up to the temple. So it could be that that's where they start their journey. Ezekiel and his guide enter from the east. They measure the north and then the south. So they start measuring the temple off and get some sizes for the temple. From the southern outer court, Ezekiel and his guide move into the inner court, and they travel around to the north, and they keep measuring as they go. And you can read this and get all the details. Again, the details are important, and they would be important for people at the time. Like, this is what God is going to do, and he's not just doing general sorts of things. He's doing very specific things. Right now, my house, or my family is in the process of looking and preparing and trying to buy a house for our eventual move. But it's very hard because we're 800 miles away from where we'd be moving. And so anytime we look at something, it's kind of like guessing a lot. I mean, they do pictures, but are you guys familiar much with, have you ever looked at housing pictures? They always take them with really weird lenses and angles. So that, like, the house always looks like the Taj Mahal type of thing, right? It doesn't matter how small this is. It's like, boom! And then, like, you try to get some measurements and you realize, like, that bathroom was this big. Like, we're not sure. There is a toilet in the picture, but I'm pretty sure it's a doll toilet. That's the only way to make it work. But what we did as a family for some things, we were looking at a home, is we went and got a tape measure, and we went into a room, and we measured, like, okay, given what they were saying, this is how big this room would be, so we could get an idea for, it was one of the kids, so this is how big the room is that we're talking about that would be your room, and kind of comparing size. And like, hey, guess what? You're going to have to get rid of, now you know how much stuff you have to get rid of, because this is all the size you have, and your room right now is bigger than that. Tough luck. And, some of that happens. But for the Israelites, it's expansive. They're getting out, they're hearing what's going on and going, oh, this is much better than it sounded like it was going to be. It's huge. And so he keeps measuring as he goes along for this process. The inner court also has buildings for the priests who are serving. That's your blank there, who are serving. But those who may offer sacrifices and those... Oh, this shouldn't be a but. That should be a for. It's for those who may be offering the sacrifices and those who are just doing the general service in the temple. So they're going around and measuring this stuff. One of the things I would like you to realize at this point, when they're measuring it, the angel is measuring with a royal cubit. So he has a rod with him that's establishing length, and he has the cord with him. The cord is so you can measure, in spaces, and then you put it against the rod to see how long that was. But the cord can go, around things and in things and stuff like that, and a rod can't. So that's why he's got both things. He uses the cord and then he measures against the rod. The cubits that he is using is not a standard cubit. Standard cubit is roughly 18 inches from elbow to fingertip. The convenience of that is you always have an elbow and a fingertip, ideally. So you can measure stuff. And we all know how this works, right? I'm sure everyone here at some point in your life, you have measured something like this. And you try to carry it over and see, does it fit or something like that? Or you do this thing. Anyone try to carry an inch like that? Right, so we know what's going on. My problem is, like, I'm carrying like this. And I get over and I'm like, wow, it didn't seem that big. But I've totally messed up. So that's why they use the rod, so it's standard. He's not using a standard cubit, which would be 18 inches. He's using a royal cubit, which is a royal cubit would be your elbow to tip, and then a hand span. So it's a little bit longer, the royal cubit is. So it can be up to 6 inches. So a royal cubit is a bit longer. It'd be between 20 and 24 inches. All right, so they measure everything inside. Once they get that measured, then they look at the gates and things like that. Once the gates are considered, at the end of chapter 40, consideration is given to the front of the temple itself, which would open to the inner sanctuary. This is, and you can see the inner court kind of thing in the front of the temple there. So they give some consideration to that stuff. Then in chapter 41, the temple itself is measured. Also, some consideration is given to the decoration inside of the temple, because you want to not just know the size, you want to see how it's set up. So they look inside the temple. I say here in verses 1 to 26, notice that the representation of the cherubim is not unlike what Ezekiel has seen. All right, so in the temple there are decorations along the walls and things of cherubim. And when he describes them, he's describing something that is similar to what he himself has seen, as far as like the heads and those things. Let's see, verse 18. It was carved of cherubim and palm trees, a palm tree between cherub and cherub. Each cherub had two faces, a human face toward the palm tree on the one side, and the face of a young lion toward the palm tree on the other side. They were carved on the whole temple all around. Now, the cherubim that Ezekiel had seen had how many faces? Four. Do you remember what they were? So, not exactly do we remember. That was a long time ago. That's fair. So we had man. They had a face like a man, a face like a lion, a face like an eagle, a hawk kind of thing, and then a face like a goat or a cow, something like that. So when he sees these, they have two faces, right? They have the human and the lion thing, which is at least similar. Now, they don't show all four faces because it turns out in a piece of artwork, unless you're making something that's multidimensional or a tesseract, you can't draw all four sides of the animal in one thing on a flat surface. It's a 2D issue. That's why platforming gamers Mario looks so funky, because his face is flat, because you always only see him from the side, right? But then when you get into like Mario, I remember the one that had the painting. The 64, when that finally came out, and then you could see Mario, you could see him all around and realize, man, he really is fat. You know? Before we saw a profile, now we see the whole thing. Well, Ezekiel's looking at just the profile of these cherubs. So he only sees two of the faces, because you don't see all four faces. The other two faces would be on the other side, but you're not on the other side of the wall, to see that, and no one's gonna take the time to carve the other side of the wall and then glue it up, because that would be sad to lose that. But he sees the two. Point is, it's not unlike what he's seen. So he's this theme of the cherubs kind of connected all the way through the book of Ezekiel. Into chapter 42, as we continue to measure things now, the temple itself is measured. Also, some consideration is given to the decoration. Oh, that was 41. Consideration is also given to the various chambers, which will be present in the temple. These chambers are provided to the serving priests so that they have a place to keep the offerings, eat the offerings, keep their garments, and so on and so forth. So the temple itself, when you go into the temple, has like the main chamber, which is dedicated to worship and those kinds of things. But off the main chamber, you have some side chambers so that you can have, like, they're basically closets and little rooms and things, so you have storage. Storage space is important. And that's what they have. So the 40, 41, and 42 is dedicated to measuring out, getting a picture of the temple itself, what it's like. From that point forward, Ezekiel then starts to talk about the worship that goes on in the new temple. So that starts in chapter 43. So then he led me to the gate facing east, and behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the east. And the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters. So he had like this roaring, rushing kind of sound. And the earth shone with his glory. And the vision I saw was just like the vision that I had seen when he came to destroy the city. And just like the vision I had seen by the Kabar Canal. And I fell on my face. That is, it's the vision of God up on the palanquin being carried by the chariot. Like that thing he had at the beginning that overwhelmed him. He sees that again now as God is coming into the city. As the glory of the Lord entered the temple by the gate facing east, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. So in this first portion of 43, once more, Ezekiel is witness to the incredible glory of the Lord. In this instance, however, the glory of the Lord is coming into the temple, which is a beautiful thing for Ezekiel. The glory of the Lord comes from the east, comes through the gate, and enters into the temple. So you can kind of see in the little picture, there's a blue line. Do you see the, well, it's not blue on your paper. But it's the little line that goes like by the altar and then kind of comes through and runs out the right side. Is that, you see the line? Yeah, the river of life. That's it, which is why it's blue in mine, because mine's in color. It's good to know people. So, the Spirit of God, the presence of God, the glory of God comes in kind of along that line. It goes through the entrance, not along the river, but it goes through the entrance into the inner temple. And Ezekiel sees this whole thing. This is incredibly important to give completion to Ezekiel's vision. If you'll remember earlier in Ezekiel, he saw the glory of the Lord leave, not just leave the temple, but leave Jerusalem. And when that happened, the glory of the Lord left and went what direction? Do you recall? It went east. And we connected that, like there was some stuff where it went out to the Mount of Olives and it raised off and left. Well, now when it returns from the east. It's a full return of the Lord in his glory. And he comes into the temple and he comes into the inner sanctuary and he fills the temple with his glory. So it's an overwhelming thing for Ezekiel to see, but it's also an exciting thing for Ezekiel to see and realize God has come back. It's not just a matter of promise. It is also a matter of presence. The Lord is there. Verses 6 through 12, the Lord speaks to Ezekiel and assures him of the sacredness of this place and the permanence now of his presence. He says, you know, let the Israelites put away all the stuff. And then at the end of verse 9, I will dwell in their midst forever. Now that I am here, now that we've resolved everything, we're going to have this relationship forever. This is an eternal matter. Verses 43, or chapter 43, 13 through 27, consideration is given to the altar and the sacrifices which take place on the altar. That is, now that God has entered into the temple, a point is made regarding how Israel will relate to their God. So this is interesting because before, we got all the measurements. He went around, he told us exactly what everything looked like. You know, he gives you sizes and dimensions and everything. But he didn't really talk anything about what they were doing in the temple. Just this is what it looked like. Now that the presence of the Lord is in the temple, he takes up a consideration of some of the things that they're doing and how they make sacrifices in that type of business. Which takes us into chapter 44 then. The gate by which the Lord has entered the temple. Remember, he came from the east. So it would be the eastern gate that he came through. Yes. Right. I think it means it's easier to go get your sacrificial animal. Don't have to worry about the sheep biting you or anything like that. I don't think there's a particular issue. We get some sense of what the sacrifices are going to be like in Ezekiel. And my thinking based on their history and culture is that what the anticipation is that they're going to have, like, they're going to have a flock that's their purpose, is they're dedicated to that. So the glory came through the eastern gate, so the eastern gate is to remain closed. That gate is for the Lord. So no people are going to go through the gate. That gate is for the Lord. That's kind of the sense of this. And because the Lord has come through, the Lord in His glory has come through that gate, it wouldn't be right for us to tread upon it. That's His and His alone, so we're not going to let people through it. But it remains closed, not just so people won't walk through it, but that's kind of hinting at and reminding us God is there forever. He's not going to leave either. He doesn't have to have the gate remain open in case He decides to get out. It's a shut deal. This would be a continual testimony of the Lord's presence there in the temple. However, there is some discussion here that the prince may use this vestibule as his to eat. He can go there to eat in the eastern gate, but he will not pass through the gate. That gate is for God the Father alone. There is some debate about who the prince is. I would kind of take it that it's the Messiah, but I recognize there's some debate about that. That it's the Messiah to me, that it's Jesus, makes sense why he gets to use and partake in this gate. And then his not passing through is not because he's not equal with God, but it's a recognition of the position of who God is. Continuing through chapter 44, Ezekiel speaks regarding how the priests are to operate in this new temple. In summary, just to kind of give you a summary of all of those verses, the priests are to be holy as they are serving a holy God. They will have access to the offerings, but they will also be sanctified among all the people. So they're just supposed to really be the epitome of what they should have been from the beginning. That takes us to chapter 45, and we begin to deal with the logistics of the new temple. And now that we have, we have the structure and we have kind of what's going on here, let's think about what some of that means for the rest of Israel. In chapter 45 at the beginning, verses 1 through 8, we get a division of the land, again. In the division of the land, which will be considered at length later, he's going to go through and deal with the land significantly in a little bit. A portion is to be set aside for the Lord. In this land, the temple is where the temple will be. It will not be within land apportioned to any tribe. The temple stands outside of that. It's like Washington, D.C., right? It doesn't belong to any state. It's its own district. And that's what's going to happen here. There's going to be a particular district set aside for the temple and for these things. It won't belong to anyone. Likewise, the prince, who I'm taking to be the Messiah, will have a portion of land that will be on either side of this holy district. So, any particular color anyone's feeling? What about red? In our beautiful, beautiful picture, all things have a green. Here's Israel. Jerusalem's roughly about here, and what's going to happen is we'll have a district that's set aside for the temple. And then there is a land here that belongs to the prince. It's his land. Inside of that is where the temple district is set aside for the temple.
probably where flocks of the sheep and some of the other stuff in correct condition. So anyone traveling, they're going to leave their own land to come into this country area. And now their own land doesn't belong to anyone except the prince or to the temple itself.
We'll come back to that picture in a minute. Yes. They use the term prince in kind of civil leader positions. So, and like I said, the identity of the prince in different things. It would be good to read. Because I don't think Wearsby and I are totally on the same page here, if I remember right. But there are going to be other things, other positions about who the prince might be. I'm taking, the prince, when it's talking about the prince, I'm taking that to be the Messiah because of some of the things associated with him. That he gets to eat in the east gate, that he owns a particular strip of land all on his own, and that the temple's inside of that land speaks to me that we're probably not dealing with just civil leaders, but we're dealing with the civil leader, would be my assumption. When it goes into plural, you're looking much more at just general civil leadership or things like that. And context is going to determine what we view it as. It's not something I'm going to get really caught up with someone about if they disagree with the identification of the prince. It just seems to make the most sense to me in reading. So through the rest then of chapter 45 and 46, significant consideration is given to the various sacrifices and feasts that they are to offer and celebrate. This includes some of how things are to be handled, how the people are to even enter and exit the temple. Of course, they can't go through the east. So they have to come in from the north or the south. They don't really come in through the west for various reasons. But if you consider this map, it would be practical for them not to come in through the western gate because to the west is just the prince's land. So no one's coming from that direction. You're coming from the north or south. You just come into the gate. You follow the road in and you go into the temple from where you were at. The conclusion of the whole section is that the sacredness of the temple and the holiness of God will always be maintained and witnessed. People will always see it, and it will always be present, and that's kind of the whole summary of the section through chapter 46. And it gives you a lot of the details about the stuff that's going on there and how they function with that. Alright, then in the last closing chapters of the book, we get the land associated with the new temple. Coming out of the temple and flowing into the land will be a river. It was the river of life, which we saw is a gray line in your notes. This river becomes deeper as it flows east and eventually becomes impassable because of its significance. Wherever it flows, it brings abundance and blessing. There's a couple of important things to realize about this. It's predicted in a number of places that in the millennial kingdom, Jerusalem is going to be lifted up. So physically, it's going to be exalted. Now, there's debate about when the prophets are talking about that, are they talking about it physically being moved? Because it says it'll be higher than any other mountain. Or is it just talking about it's going to be more special, exalted in a metaphorical sort of sense? I would take it, based on the language and the repetition in multiple prophets where that gets stated, I would take it to be that there is geographical changes that take place at the end of the tribulation and the beginning of the millennial kingdom. It makes sense that you would have some of that given all the stuff that's happening in the tribulation. There has to be some recovery of things. There's all sorts of, you know, there's hailstones, earthquakes, and all of that stuff. So I'm totally fine saying geographically things get reoriented. But what happens then is you've got Jerusalem and the temple kind of is the chief thing there, and then this river flowing out of it. But Jerusalem is high. I mean, even now, it's on a hill, it's on a mount. So the water there is kind of more of a nice spring type of thing that's creating this river. And then as it comes down and flows out to the east, it just becomes deeper and deeper until it's impassable. You can't go across it because it's getting wider too, as it increases and flows. Verses 13 through 23, Ezekiel begins a discussion of how the land is to be divided. This summary division considers the borders of the nation of Israel. Which is part of why I think we're looking at the millennial kingdom here, is because he's talking about Israel in relation to the nations, and there's borders and things like that. In the eternal state, that stuff would be irrelevant. But in the millennial kingdom, it's still significant because there are other nations. So he talks about the borders and the division of land. In chapter 48, the land is divided among the tribes. Note that this division does not correspond to the division of land given earlier by Joshua. This land is divided anew. We need a competing color now. Go blue. Alright, so in the old division of land, you had, you know, Judah was down here, Simeon's in here, Dan is kind of up in here, Ephraim is over here, Benjamin's right there, Zebulun, we have Manasseh, you know, people all over. You kind of remember that from Joshua? In this new division, Ezekiel takes a completely different method of dividing the land as he describes it. It's no longer divided like that. And if you've read through Joshua when you get to the end, like it's hard for us because he's giving all these like signs and landmarks and things. We have no, no place to put that in your mind, right? He's like, you go down the hill until you hit this and then you turn left. And I'm like, I don't know where any of that is. So I read through it, but I'm like, well, that's nice, Joshua. It would have been nice if he's giving me GPS coordinates or something so I could track it, but I have no idea where any of this is. When I was a student here at the church I went to for my Christian service assignment, I went there all 3 years I was here. I enjoyed my church very much. But we were there one day and they were going to have a potluck kind of thing at someone's house. They were hosting like a potluck, come fellowship with us. And said, and I kid you not, this is the directions to their house. Like they named a particular road. You go down that road till you see the antelope. There's a herd of antelope there and you turn left and, you know, we're another 2 miles up. And all of us were like, antelope move, right? But apparently this particular herd was very stable. So, it was the landmark. I'm like, that's not a helpful landmark because, things move. I'm going to end up in some place. It worked, but, it was still strange. That's how Joshua, like, outlines everything. Ezekiel's like, no, we're going to take a totally different method when we divide the land in the future. And it's an easy method. You have Israel established like that, and he says, here it is. And that's how it's cut up. Just straight lines. This is your land. Makes it a lot easier, right? You start here and you go east until you get to the end of the nation. That's now the border of your tribe. And so he just goes through, ding, 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 ding. From top to bottom, there's everyone's land. Congratulations. So in some ways, it's easier to understand what's going on, but it's a little foreign as we read through the Old Testament because we've gotten very used to like, oh, this tribe's over here and that tribe's over there and stuff like that. And then Ezekiel says, in the future, it's not going to be like that. It's just going to be because we don't need to worry about all the things. So it's just going to be land set apart like this. And I don't have a good picture of that, but I know any number of commentaries would have a picture of how that is, like you could actually see the lines. And that's how Ezekiel sets that up. Finally, at the end of the book, consideration is given to Jerusalem and the situation of its gates. Seems like a weird place to end, talking about the gates of Jerusalem. But where Ezekiel has been, I mean, we just have had this whole discussion about the temple. It's so personal to Ezekiel. It's so important to Ezekiel because he's the one who sets up, he's the priest, and he's talking about all this idolatry, and so he gets to see the new temple, and that's a wonderful thing. But Ezekiel is also one to the refugees. He's the one who has been telling them about the fall of Jerusalem. And he has predicted the fall, and he's had to deal with it, right? He went through all those things he did, the eating of the weird bread, laying on his side, all that stuff, being mute until the city fell. He has a huge relationship to the fall of the city. So when he ends, and he's ending on this note of, let me tell you about the gates of the city, that is a significant step in change. I'm not thinking about the destruction of the city. I'm not talking about it being plowed under anymore. I'm not talking about the walls being thrown down. I'm talking about it being established. And the gates are kind of the end of the establishing thing. They're the crown on top of everything else, that it has gates. So he says at the end of the book, these shall be the exits of the city on the north side, which is to be 4,500 cubits by measure. Three gates, the gate of Reuben, the gate of Judah, and the gate of Levi. The gates of the city shall be being named after the tribes of Israel on the east side, which is to be 4,500 cubits. Three gates, the gates of Joseph, of Benjamin, and of Dan. On the south side, again, 4,500 cubits, that's Simeon, Issachar, and Zebulun. And on the west side, which is to be 4,500 cubits, Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. The circumference of the city shall be 18,000 cubits, and the name of the city from that time on shall be The Lord Is There. Yeah, because it kind of goes back to the actual tribes, and now Levi isn't like that interspersed kind of tribe where they lose tribal identity. They now have tribal identity, and so to keep things at 12, we roll Manasseh and Ephraim back to Joseph. So this is for balance. There's encouraging things here. Dan gets a gate. Dan has been a tribe full of trouble for like the entire existence. I don't remember. I mean, some of you may have heard this before. I don't remember. It must be in Judges class to talk about it. That like in Dan's existence as a tribe, there was like maybe 100 years it wasn't struggling with idolatry, like severely struggling with idolatry. But God purifies the whole nation, and so it's His grace. Something else that's interesting about these gates. The gates are like boom, 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 something like that. They're all the sides. So I imagine the roads that come from this direction, you know, they may have come, some that do come in this way, from the east or from the west or something like that. So you can use those gates. Otherwise, the gates that are just there don't go anywhere. And that seems not something God would do. I would imagine if the gates were there, they go somewhere. Otherwise, I think you would put six on one side, six on the other. So there's roads here that can be used, but when you get inside, so the city is a square, and when you come inside, you still have to come into the north and south when you get to the temple itself. Because that's the way it's set up.
That's where the book ends. The city is reestablished. It's good times. Any questions before I dismiss you? Yes. The sacrifices in the millennial kingdom won't be as in the same way that they were in the Old Testament, is a covering for sin.
in the Old Testament, they're anticipatory. They're looking toward Christ. We're going to cover our sin now because we know a sacrifice is coming. In the millennial kingdom, they're celebratory because our sins are forgiven and we're remembering what Christ has done to forgive our sins. So sacrifices are still very similar, but the objective is different in how they're being performed. Was there another? Yes. I think it is. It may be like the one of the tribulation may give some bones to this one, but I think it's going to be reestablished. All right, you are dismissed. Go and have fun in your chapel-y class kind of thing. Is it here?
Yeah.
Oh, never mind. I'm going to go and have fun.